Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. You have certainly seen the news coverage concerning the family in Minnesota. The focus of a great deal of legal attention and police attention because the mom in this case took the 13-year-old boy away so that he would not receive the chemotherapy treatments that were indicated not only by doctors but by court order. She and her son returned to Minnesota on Memorial Day, and today those chemotherapy treatments are to resume. I want to say what we're talking about today. I wrote an article. The Washington Post Newsweek magazine called me, emailed me, actually, and requested an article on this from a Christian perspective. I responded with an article published at my website, also at the Washington Post and Newsweek, entitled, When Medicine and Faith Collide, What About the Child? And I'll be making the argument I make there in that article, but this is one of those issues that really needs to be discussed. And I've received a lot of feedback to this article. Some of it a little strange, some of it very interesting, but I want to invite you to talk about this issue. We have a situation in which, by the law of this nation, in all 50 states, the state has an obligation to protect the life of the child and at some point to intervene when parents claim faith healing or some other claim, usually of a religious nature, as it turns out, whereby they want their child to be denied medical treatment. So we're talking here about established law, but we're talking about current controversy, and we're also talking about some discussion on the conservative end of the spectrum about what this means in terms of parental authority, in terms of the role of government, and all the rest. There are tricky issues here. We're going to be talking about it today on the Albert Mohler Program. I'd love to have you call. The number is 877-893-8255. There's still time for you to go to the website, albertmohler.com. I did not post an article on top of that column precisely because I wanted it to be there for our discussion today. If you go to albertmohler.com, it'll be the first article you'll see. When Medicine and Faith Collide, What About the Child? We'll be talking about that today. I'd love to hear from you. You really need to think this issue through because it gets to some of the most basic issues about the role and authority of parents, about the role of the state, about state intervention within the realm of family life. And it also gets to the issue of Christianity and modern medicine. So there are some fascinating issues for our discussion. It ought to be really illuminating. I want to invite you to call 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We'll all be getting to that in just a moment. We'll get to your phone calls as well as emails. Just write us at mail@albertmohler.com. You can also communicate with us by Twitter at Albert Mohler or Mohler Radio. We'll be glad to hear from you. And we'll get to that issue in just a moment. First, to review some other issues in the news. The headlines in the New York Times are very interesting today. Here's the headline. Bush v. Gore foes joined to fight California gay marriage ban. It's talking about the fact that David Boies and Ted Olson appeared yesterday as co-counsel in a federal lawsuit that is seeking to undo Proposition 8 in California, not by taking it to the California court. After all, that court ruled on Tuesday, rather taking it to the federal courts, making a federal claim that this constitutes a denial of civil rights. The complaint was filed last week in federal district court in San Francisco on behalf of two gay couples. It was formally announced Wednesday at a news conference in Los Angeles. As the New York Times reports, the attorneys argue against Proposition 8 due to federal constitutional guarantees of equal protection and due process. Now, I'm not going to discuss today the merits of this argument. I'm simply going to point out the interesting character of the timing and also the issue that the timing is of concern not only for those who want to see the case come before the courts now, but those who do not. I hold in my hands a very interesting article also from the Washington Times, a headline in this one by Julia Dean, Gay Leaders Counsel Against Federal Suits. Let me just read to you the first paragraph here. She reports, a split among pro-gay groups occurred Wednesday as a coalition of nine prominent national groups cautioned allies against going to federal courts to challenge Proposition 8 of California through two, it says, though two couples have already filed a lawsuit challenging the amendment as a violation of the U.S. Constitution. Make change, not lawsuits, is the theme of the seven-page document. It argued that appeals to federal courts are premature before a grassroots effort, quote, to change hearts and minds in all 50 states. It said gay rights groups should push for gay marriage through selective state courts and legislatures. So here you have a difference of opinion, a split in the judgment in the gay rights community as to which road is likely to most successfully lead to same-sex marriage nationwide. And clearly, given the Constitution and the composition of the federal courts, there are many who want to push for same-sex marriage who think that's the wrong way to do it. The timing issue also comes down, of course, to the nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor to be the next Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. I guarantee you that this puts the issue front and center in those confirmation hearings. And so this just makes it all the more interesting. As if we were not living in times that were complicated enough when it comes to our courts, there is more coming. I want to draw your attention to something that probably had your attention over the weekend. The headline in the New York Times is Seeking a Missing Link and Mass Audience. On Tuesday morning, just 2 days ago, researchers unveiled a 47-million-year-old fossil. That's what they claim, 47 million years old. That's the advertising. They said would revolutionize the understanding of human evolution. They did so at the American Museum of Natural History. And they were also, of course, unveiling a major show on the History Channel. They orchestrated the publicity. It includes a film about the, quote, secretive two-year study of the fossil. The book is released with an exclusive arrangement with ABC News, an elaborate website. Jorn Hurum, scientist at the University of Oslo, said, quote, any pop band is doing the same thing. Any athlete is doing the same thing. We have to start thinking the same way in science. Well, the same way here means publicity. Now, folks, I received a good many contacts by email, other digital communication over the weekend. Several of you wrote this website in order to say, what should we think about this? Is this the missing link? Does this prove evolution? Well, of course not. As a matter of fact, if you look at the news concerning this much-hyped and much-publicized event, it turns out to be much less than first appears. By the way, some of the people who have been involved in it are now embarrassed by it. This happened, of course, with television, with the Discovery Channel, and the supposed lost tomb of Jesus controversy last year, where all kinds of claims were made, much scientific and publicity hype. The supposed unveiling, the National Geographic Society and complicity coming out with a book and all of its coverage, and then a lot of backtracking immediately thereafter when it turned out the claims were made were pretty suspicious on the face. Now you have the claim that this is supposedly the missing link in human evolution. The claim is that this particular fossil, again, they claim it to be 47 million years old, is a primate, an early primate in the same line as advanced primate and human development. They claim such things as, like humans, all of its toes have nails. Very interesting. Arms and legs are relatively short, like humans. On and on. Its short face is more reminiscent of humans than lower primates like lemurs. Forward-facing eyes would have given it 3D vision and the ability to judge distance. Well, Jens Franzen of the Schenkenberg Research Institute in Frankfurt, who helped analyze the fossil, said she is representative of an ancestor group that gave rise to higher primates. He went on to say she's not our great-great-great-grandmother, but our great-great-great-aunt. Well, a lot of folks aren't buying this at all. As a matter of fact, there are a good many others who've come out to say it says nothing of the kind. And as a matter of fact, this fossil, whatever it is, even if you buy into the whole idea of these fossils, is not what is claimed here. Christopher Beard of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh said, I actually don't think it's terribly close to the common ancestral line of monkeys, apes, and people. I would say it's about as far away as you can get from that line and still be a primate. Rather than a long-ago ant, quote, I would say it's more like a third cousin twice removed. Well, that doesn't make for very good publicity, for hype, for a book sale, a news package, and a special on the History Channel. John Flegel of State University of New York at Stony Brook said that the scientists' analysis provides only, quote, a pretty weak link between the new creature and higher primates. Now, one of the things that's been pointed out is that science, in terms of, you know, the scientific method and what the scientific establishment is always pointing to is the purity of their very objective process, the way they claim it, of their empirical study. It's not usually done this way. It's not usually announced on the History Channel. It's not usually hyped like this. It's usually published in scientific journals, and, well, you know pretty much the story. Well, one of the men involved in this, Philip Gingrich, a paleontologist at the University of Michigan, said that the latest discovery will prove significant but asked in an interview last week whether the study ought to have been published in a prestigious journal like Science or Nature, he said, "There was a TV company involved and time pressure. We've been pushed to finish the study. It's not how I like to do science." Folks, I raise this because there are an awful lot of people who see the news reports on something like this, a highly hyped scientific discovery. What you don't see is when the claims are withdrawn in fairly short order. The damage is done. That was with the Lost Tomb of Jesus controversy. It's likely to be with this as well. A lot of backtracking. Consider the source and beware the hype. Good principles for thinking as you consider these issues in the news. We're going to come back to talk about when the state has the right or the responsibility to intervene in the medical care of children. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. Coast to coast, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're talking about when the state has the right or responsibility to intervene in parental decisions concerning the medical care of children. And this is, of course, in the headlines. The headlines most recently involving Daniel Hauser, a 13-year-old Minnesota boy who has Hodgkin's lymphoma. His mother, Colleen Hauser, defied legal authorities and took the boy, it is thought, to Mexico for non-traditional treatments for his cancer. The boy and his mother returned on Memorial Day. The Hausers believe in medical practices based on Native American traditions. They did not want him to receive the chemotherapy called for by physicians. And by the time the boy was brought back on Memorial Day, the tumor had grown so large it was pressing against his chest and lungs and heart. He is receiving chemotherapy starting today, but he's been allowed to stay with his parents so long as they abide by the orders of the court. In another highly publicized case, Leilani Newman of Wausau, Wisconsin, was convicted just last week of second-degree reckless homicide in the death of her 11-year-old daughter. Her daughter, again, 11 years old, named Madeline Kara Newman, had diabetes. The mother claimed a belief in faith healing as her rationale for refusing medical treatment for her daughter. According to medical authorities who testified at the trial, insulin and fluids would easily have kept the girl alive. Mrs. Newman now awaits sentencing there in Wisconsin. Now, the cases that are before us are troubling cases. I'm troubled because, well, at many levels, I'm offended that there are people who would claim faith healing as a rejection for medical treatment. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that in order to believe that that God heals, we have to deny access to all medical care. The Christian church has not believed that. That is an extreme unbiblical teaching that is in no way necessitated by the Christian gospel. And it sets up a false dichotomy and conflict between faith and science that is injurious, I believe, to the gospel and to the cause of Christ. I think we look to be something other than what a gospel people should look to be when we have Christians arrested for allowing their children to die because in a claim of faith healing, they let a child die of diabetes. There's just something horribly wrong with that. Another recent case involved a 16-year-old boy in Oregon. He died a painful death when his parents refused medical treatment. It started out as a simple urinary tract infection. These parents also claimed a belief in faith healing. They denied the boy medical attention. He died a very painful death. Medical authorities say that a mere catheter, inserting a catheter, would have been all that would have been necessary to save the boy's life. So again, I think this brings disrepute upon the cause of Christ, but I'm troubled at other levels as well because I'm a parent. And I'm even reluctant to use the word parental rights because when you use the rights language, it implies something that needs ratification by some other body. I don't believe that parents actually have rights when it comes to their children. I believe they have authority and they have responsibility when it comes to their children. And in the sacred realm of the family, I have great fear about the state intervening. And to have the state intervene in this area, well, I'll be honest, it raises all kinds of concerns about the state interfering and intervening when it comes to a parent's decisions about education or discipline or religious upbringing or any number of other issues. And given the expansive reach of the state and the power of the state, this is something that should require our very close attention. And the state has sought, different states, different governments, and different contexts, have sought to contravene parental authority in every one of those issues. But when it comes to the health of a child at the very point where the child will live or die, this is where I would point to the fact that there's an amazing cultural consensus in this country. A consensus that basically unites both liberals and conservatives, that unites both Christians and secularists. When it comes to cases such as the ones we have mentioned, especially the ones related to the 16-year-old boy with the catheter, all that was needed to save his life, and with an 11-year-old girl robbed of insulin and fluids, all that would have been necessary to save her life, when those parents claim a belief in God's healing as the rationale for refusing medical treatment, I've got to tell you, I think the state does have the duty to intervene. And I'm pained to say that. I do not say that without all kinds of concerns about the state's intervention. But at the end of the day, I cannot sacrifice the lives of these children to the principle of parental authority. And I believe to do so would bring disrepute upon the claim of parental authority. And if made in a Christian context, with the claim of the Christian gospel, would bring disrepute upon the church as well. I'd love to know what you think. I can tell you when I wrote the article, and I published it on Tuesday, I left it up intentionally until today. I did not publish another article on top of it because I wanted to have plenty of time for folks to respond to it. I can tell you I've gotten a lot of response. Most of the response, I'll tell you right front, has been negative. And that's usually true, by the way. You generally hear from the people who disagree with you far more than you hear with the people who agree with you. But I'll tell you, the disagreement has come from people who have said, I don't believe the state ever has a right to intervene. And for you to acknowledge the state ever has a right to intervene, then it really creates the opening for the state to intervene wrongly. Well, the problem I have with that is that I don't think the people who are making that argument actually believe it. I want to invite you to call and make your argument, but believe the argument you make. Because I don't believe even those who responded so negatively to my column actually would want the state to stand by passively as a child is writhing in agony for lack of a catheter and simple antibiotics. Or when a child is dying of a diabetic coma when all that is necessary is insulin and fluids. If I'm wrong and you want to make that case, well, you're going to have your opportunity. But I want to hear from you. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I raise this issue because those of us who operate out of what we hope and pray is a Christian worldview, when we make a claim in which we're making a claim as Christians to a unique understanding, a biblical context, to parental authority and parental responsibility, we got to track that out in the real-world decision-making that's going on here. These are headlines that are not accidental. These are headlines that recur over and over and over again because there are parents who make these claims, and it really throws open the entire question. I get calls from reporters. I get calls from people all over the media who say, does Christianity require this? And, of course, the answer is no. Most of us take our children to doctors. Now, we may have differences of opinion over specific medical treatments. Parents ought to have the absolute authority to choose the medical treatments that are most advisable for their children up until the point, and this is the crucial issue, up until the point where the health and life of the child is clearly at stake. Now, drawing that line is very difficult. That's why the courts have a very difficult time actually coming to these cases and taking on a parental role. I think it ought to be a very, very high threshold. But to deny that that threshold exists, I find, is an even greater problem. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're going to get right back. The phone lines, I guarantee you right now, are entirely lighted. Folks are ready to talk about this. There's still an opportunity for you to call. Write us at mail@albertmoeller.com. Send us a message by Twitter at Albert Moeller or Moeller Radio. Let us hear from you at Facebook at the Albert Moeller Program. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. We'll be right back with your calls.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This is obviously an issue that that incites a lot of conversation. I'll tell you something, and I'm going to admit this for the first time, I think, on this radio program. I was a bit truly disconcerted by some of the responses that came to me after I published this article. And let me tell you, I'm disconcerted at one level because a lot of people argued against things I didn't even mention in the article, or tried to make something like chemotherapy the issue. That's not really the issue here. The issue is whether or not the state ever has the right to intervene. Not even the right. It's wrong to speak about the state having rights. Whether the state has a duty to intervene in a case like this. And I think clearly the state does. And I say that regrettably. It's lamentable. And just before we go to the calls, and we've got some great calls coming on the line, just hold on just a moment. I just want to remind you that there is settled case law on this. Just so you know, this isn't something where judges are acting in an ad hoc basis. In 1944, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the case Prince v. Massachusetts that the rights of parents are fundamental. And it said so in beautiful language. Listen to this. This is important language. When you think about homeschool controversies, when you think about whether the state has a right to tell you how to raise your children, discipline your children, just remember this. This is the U.S. Supreme Court, 1944. Quote, it is cardinal with us. Cardinal, by the way, is legal for fundamental. Against cardinal right, fundamental right, same thing. It is cardinal with us that the custody, care, nurture of the child reside first in the parents, whose primary function and freedom include preparation for obligations the state can neither supply nor hinder. And it is in recognition of this that these decisions have respected the private realm of family life, which the state cannot enter, end quote. I love that language, the private realm of family life, which the state cannot enter. We got to live by that. But the same decision went on to say that there were specific cases where the welfare of the child would draw state authorities into this private realm. And I'm going to quote the decision again. Quote, the right to practice religion, let me read to it precisely. The right to practice religion freely does not include liberty to expose the community or the child to communicable disease or the latter to ill health or death, end quote. Goes back to 1944. These cases aren't new. But it is tragic that they continue. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Thomas is listening on WFIA. What are you thinking, Thomas?
I agree with the fact that a parent should not neglect medical attention. But if we give the state the right to step in with a child, at what point will the state then say that adults don't have the right to neglect their own health?
Yeah, Thomas, very interesting question, and this is where the language is slippery. And I'm going to try to watch the language myself. I've slipped a couple of times already on this program where I've spoken about the state having a right. Citizens have rights. People have rights. The state doesn't have rights. The state does have duties, and it has rightful application of those duties and wrongful application of those duties. So I don't want to say that the state has the right to intervene here. I do want to acknowledge at times it has the duty. Now, where is the protection? Thomas, at this point, the law is very clear that if you are an adult, you have the right to refuse medical treatment. Now, how that all works out through the entire society is a little bit different. Your employer may not agree with that. Your insurance company may not continue you with insurance if you take a certain course of action. But in terms of the state requiring you to undergo certain medical treatment, unless it is at the point where the state has removed you as a competent adult to make decisions in your own terms, that happens when someone's committed to a psychiatric society into a psychiatric institution. It's true when someone is deemed not to be mentally competent, and so there are legal mechanisms to do that, but that's what it requires. Now, in terms of your fear, yes, I have to tell you that there are things I would fear that the government would do if it were not constrained by the power of the people. And that's where, again, vigilance is necessary. But that is not the case with minors in the same sense. Minors, as a matter of settled law, are under the care and under the authority of parents who make those medical decisions. And by the way, this gets to another issue, which isn't for our conversation today, but it's just right before us, isn't it? I mean, this gets to the fact that we believe that parents should have this authority, that they're given this authority by God long before it's acknowledged by the state. And our kids can't get a tonsillectomy without our signatures. They can't even get, you know, a shot in the school clinic without signing away form after form. But in most states, they can get an abortion without parents being involved. I wish the state were as interested in preserving unborn life to the extent it is where we see them having the duty to intervene in the case of these children. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast. And with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I want to draw attention to some emails I've received. Some of them, you know, very helpful as always. Glad to hear from all of you. Some of them I honestly don't understand in terms of the argument, but several people seem to be arguing that the state never has a right ever to intervene in this situation. One person actually wrote me and said it'd be better for the state to stand back even if the child dies and then arrest the parents for a crime in allowing the child to die. I don't think that is meant seriously. At least I hope not. I don't think anyone would argue that the state has a duty to stand by and allow a child to die in plain sight rather than to intervene. I don't believe that. I don't believe you would make that argument in anything but a fanatically committed position against the state. That's almost like anarchy. And that's not where I believe we serve the Christian church well by taking refuge. That's just not going to work. Let's go to Ben Conklin, Davis, California. Go ahead, Ben.
Hey, Albert. I think that last comment perfectly illustrates what I was going to say. Some people will disagree with your position just because they hate all state intervention. In this case, the body of constitutional law presumes that state actions that interfere in the family are unconstitutional as a presumption because they want to guard against state action. But in egregious situations like this where kids are dying, they allow for state action, and I think that's the way it has to be. Like, view to the contrary would allow parental omissions to amount to abuse, and you can't have that. It's an insane position.
Okay. Ben, you're very articulate in defending that position. You know, you've thought through this issue. Where was the threshold that you would draw? In other words, if someone turned to you and said, okay, Judge Ben, you're going to decide when the state does have the duty to intervene, how would you articulate that point?
Well, I'll try. It's complicated. I've spent a lot of time studying it, but there's times when kind of what are termed insular minority groups are discriminated against, and there's also these issues of kind of health, safety, and welfare of individuals, and that's kind of the constitutional law term of art is health, safety, and welfare. And I think it's pretty clear when a kid doesn't get a catheter that he needs to survive, that would probably activate the state's duty to look out for the health, safety, and welfare of the child.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that case is the clearest. You know, the 16-year-old boy, all he needed was a catheter and perhaps some antibiotics, and there's no reason it should have gone badly at all. No reason that it should have been anything other than, you know, a couple of days in bed, and then out playing softball again. I mean, this just doesn't make any sense. I think the harder cases come in something like the Hauser case in Minnesota, and it is a bit more difficult because there you have parents who say, we don't believe in no treatment. We're going to claim the authority to use an alternative treatment. And my understanding of the law as it came down in this case in Minnesota was that the law said that if that alternative therapy had worked, if there had been immediate results, if indeed the boy's cancer appeared to shrink, it would not become a court issue. But when doctors go and say, and that's what I understand happened in this case, doctors went to the court and said, this boy is now trending toward death if we do not indeed use chemotherapy, and then they had to bring scientific evidence about the efficacy of that. This, according to medical authorities, is a very treatable cancer, and there's every reason to believe that the boy has a good chance of surviving this. That's the threshold. The threshold is when the life, the welfare of the child is in imminent danger, not just in theoretical danger, not just in some kind of out in the future distant danger, but in very near and proximate immediate danger. Ben's call is very helpful. Let's go to State College, Pennsylvania. Michael's listening on WTLR. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi. I just wanted to say I agree with your article. I'm disappointed that you've had so much negative response. The scriptures certainly recognize the government as another authority in our lives, and there are times that it's going to have to step in to preserve innocent life. And I think in the particular case you're talking here, that's exactly what it did, and it should be commended. And frankly, church leaders and Christians should stand up and speak as you have, because those times that's another area the church can bring some pressure to bear on some of these, what I believe are probably rogue believers or something that would,
yes,
allow their child to die, for a silly reason like not inserting a catheter.
Michael, very helpful point. I appreciate your call. Let me tell you, I think one of the strongest arguments you made there, and these aren't your words, these are my words, but I hope I'm affirming what you said. You know, when the state actually acts, when there's an urgency for the state to act, we should be thankful that the state has acted. And I think the other side of that is how I wish that there had been a judge able to rule in such a way that the 16-year-old boy in Oregon's life was saved. That would be a commendable act by such a judge. Or in Wisconsin, that this 11-year-old girl was saved by a court's action, if necessary, and it apparently was necessary, to get her the insulin and fluids that she needed. So there's a sense in which, just as you mentioned here, God has given government as a gift. We need to remember that. And there's a certain conservative hostility to government that is unbiblical. There's a certain hostility to government overreaching that is necessary. I mean, we understand that in a Genesis 3 world, the government will seek to expand its power beyond all appropriate means. That's not something that should surprise us. But to argue that government has no role whatsoever is to deny what the scripture clearly teaches. Now, when it comes to the raising of children, let's be clear. The Bible goes to parents. Parents first, last, and in the middle, for that matter. Until parents, and here's the tripping point that I've been waiting for someone to mention. No one has. So let me state the theological principle, I think, that comes into play here. When parents, by their disregard for the health of their children, when they then subvert their authority as parents, that's when, I believe, someone else has to step in. And by the way, I wish there had been a church to step in first. I wish there had been a church established on the gospel with enough theological sense to get to these parents as church members and say, this is just wrong. This is a scandal to the gospel. This is not only not required by the Christian truth claim, this is a denial of means that God has given us, and it becomes a scandal to the gospel. Give your child the medicine. Lots to think about here. This is a lamentable conversation we have to have, but in a real world, we have to talk about real things, and this is all too real. Back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. You know, this is one of those issues that requires very careful thinking. You got to slice the onion with a very fine knife here. And this gets even to the language we use. And I've had to police myself because we speak the rights language almost by reflex in this country. And it's because rights is, as a category, rights are written right into the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and just about everything else. Rights talk has become so infectious in this society that, as Marianne Glendon says, professor at Harvard Law School, we generally refer to rights with far more ease than we refer to right or wrong. So that said, we do need to understand that when we talk about hard cases like this, where children are dying for need of medical care, and parents are claiming that they simply believe that God will heal and they refuse all medical treatment. This is a case in which parents really are abrogating their own authority. You know, one of the responsibilities, let's get to this, the duty language. One of the duties of a parent is to be well intended toward the child in a way that clearly is responsible. Now, in a secular age, Christian parents have a particular burden of vigilance here, because there are people who would argue that we should not have the right to discipline our children as we see fit, that we should not have the right to educate our children as we see fit, that it's child abuse, says Richard Dawkins, to raise a child according to a religious upbringing. We've got to fight all those arguments, and we've got to maintain a vigilant defense of, I got to use the word, our rights here as parents. Even when it comes to the medical treatment of our children, when it comes to some issues of vaccination and particular medical treatments and other issues, there are tricky issues here, and parents are going to have to defend the right to make these decisions based upon Christian conviction. But there is a threshold here, a tripwire. There's a tipping point that comes when the health of the child, the welfare of the child, even the life of the child, becomes clearly at stake in an urgent way. At this point, it would be irresponsible for Christians to argue that the state does not have a duty to intervene. And when the state has that duty and it accomplishes that duty, let me just point to the fact that there is no great outcry in this country. There is an amazing consensus. Whether it comes easily or it comes hard, the recognition is that there are hard cases in which state authorities have to take action that, though lamentable, is necessary. You know, all this points to what it means to live in a Genesis 3 world, in a fallen world, in a world that is suffering under the curse of sin. We have the reality of the disease, the illness, the kind of medical crises that raise this issue in the first place. And then we have the need to watch those who have power, lest they misuse that power. We need to be thankful for the grace of God, whereby we are given the authority to raise our children. May we raise them well. I'll meet you tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Miller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.